we have behind us a wonderful drawing, and it's bunny rabbits and I think lots and lots of Easter eggs. And as you know, one Easter egg is delicious, 30 or 40 is disastrous if you eat them all. And one of the interesting things is we often crave freedom and happiness. And the thing that's, it almost seems like a paradox, within Buddhism there are lots of rules and restrictions. Now how can you talk about freedom and happiness when there's lots of rules and restrictions? Because we often see rules and restrictions as limiting our behaviour or limiting our quality of life. And yet, according to even scientific facts, Buddhists seem to be some of the happiest people in the world, and yet they have many restrictions. Why do you think that's the case? Now I'm asking you a question. Why do you think that? Why do you think which restrictions would allow you to be more happy? Don't all speak at once. Come on. Have a think about it.
Restrictions sort of tell you to look elsewhere.
Tell you to look elsewhere, yeah. Any other ideas? Why would having things that limit your behaviour, yes?
Restrictions on not harming others, so that helps you to help others in that way.
Now you're on it. The answer was restrictions on harming others. So what the restrictions are in Buddhism is about doing negative actions. It's not about enjoying yourself, it's about recognizing what negative actions are. In the Eightfold Path there are three sections: wisdom, ethical conduct, and mental development. The wisdom part of it is right view. The right view. Now the right view is actually looking at reality, the way things function. The first teaching of the Buddha was about right view. What was the first teaching of the Buddha? Four Noble Truths, yes. You all know that. And what are the Four Noble Truths? That there is suffering, there is dissatisfaction. This is a view that's correct. If we analyse it, if we ask anyone, do you ever have discomfort? Do you ever have dissatisfaction? Do you ever not get what you want? Do you ever receive what you don't want? Yeah, a lot of the time. The weather's too hot. Yesterday it was too hot, now it's probably too cold. And we're constantly in this push-pull of dissatisfaction. But where does the dissatisfaction come from? Is it an external thing? When we were too hot yesterday, a cool breeze like tonight would have been absolute relief, wouldn't it? And we would have went, oh, it's fantastic. And then when it gets too cold, we're thinking, oh, it would be nice, a little bit warmth. So it depends on our mind. Depends on the way we see things. And the right view is about that. It's said here in this text that I've got, right view is the beginning and the end of the path. The way you see things. Cessation of the path is the ultimate result of the right view. The path is the way to tread, the way, the techniques, the technology of the Buddha. The Buddha was an amazing person, we know that. But what wonderful advantage that this planet had was that he taught for 50 years. Maybe 52. He was able to examine the human condition, or the condition of all beings actually, and say, look, what's the bottom line here? What is it that everyone's experiencing? They're experiencing dissatisfaction, discomfort, and suffering. Well, the Buddha said he was there to give the good news, that there is a cessation to that. He also, which is very important, taught about the cause of that suffering. And the cause of that suffering is our actions, or our karma that we create. And so right view is understanding that there are things like karma, that there is a cause and there is effect. Some people I come across say, in fact, I came across one person who said, if you don't believe in karma, it won't happen. Slightly naive. If we look at the way we even run our lives, it's related to cause and effect. I once asked my brother many years ago, just after I'd become a Buddhist, and he wasn't, I said, do you think there is randomness or karma? He said, I think there's a bit of both, some randomness and some karma. And I said, well, I think you'd have to agree that you either had randomness or karma, but if you had a bit of randomness and karma, you'd have randomness. So you only have two categories. Now, randomness means, and he gave this example. He said, if I threw a tennis ball at a wall, I wouldn't know where it's going to land. Therefore, it's random. Now, are there any science students here at the moment? Anyone doing science? Okay, what's wrong with that idea? If I throw a ball at the wall, I don't know where it's going to go, therefore it's random.
Science knows where it's going to go.
Absolutely, science knows exactly where it's going to go. And my question back to him was, do you know the velocity of the ball? Do you know the shape of the wall? Do you know the temperature of the air? Do you know the humidity? If you put in all the factors, I can predict that the ball is going to lie exactly there in 4.5 seconds. He did scratch his head. But that's the truth. There can only be cause and effect. Randomness means we have a completely chaotic universe, that you start your car and it turns into an apple, which could be very disconcerting. We base our lives on the fact that there is a cause and a result. And if we know that, then we can start to work out that if we want a certain outcome, we have to put in a certain cause, don't we? If you want misery and suffering, put in all the causes that cause misery and suffering. Miserliness, anger, hatred, all those different things create negative outcomes. All the things that we don't want come from negative causes. So in a sense, Buddhism is really very simple. In fact, Buddhism is incredibly complex and incredibly simple, which is an amazing kind of practice in the fact that you have the most diverse cultures embracing Buddhism with their own flavour and their own taste, as the Dalai Lama, many different spices. Very good. But out of that comes a really clear way to live our lives. And so by understanding what the causes are, we can create the outcomes. And therefore, all we have to do is find out what are positive causes and do those, and find out what are negative causes and do those. And so the right view is understanding that things like karma exist and seeing how that affects our lives, how generosity brings prosperity, how miserliness creates poverty. I had a really interesting experience, and I think I've told you the story, and excuse me, and many of you have been here before, so you'll get my stories again, but that's okay. I was in a situation in my life where I was down to my last $10. I was borrowing money from my rent, and I was having a very difficult time many years ago. And I looked in my wallet and I had $10, and I went, and I had enough petrol in my car. Friend was going to lend me money for rent, and I thought, okay, what am I going to do with my last $10? I know, I'm visiting my parents, so I'm going to buy them a really nice fruit tart. So I went out and bought with my last $10 a gift for my parents. I thought, there you go, that's it. And it felt really good, it felt fantastic actually, that the last $10 I had in the world was not going on me. So I bought the tart and I went to my parents' place and I gave it to my mother and she was very happy. It's a very good tart. This is going back many years, by the way. You can't get a fruit tart for $10 anymore. Anyway, so I got there and heated the tart up and had tea and everything, and then it was time for me to go. And yes, I could have asked my parents for money, but I didn't want to. It's not fair. It was my situation that I had to work with. And before I left, my mother said, I'll look in the letterbox. And many, many, many years ago, before that, when I was very young, when my grandmother passed away, she left me a small parcel of shares. And those shares earned a little dividend. And that dividend was always sent to my parents because I moved around. So before I left, my mother said, I'll just look in the letterbox. She looks in the letterbox, she pulls out an envelope, and there from the share company is $35 in an envelope. And I went, isn't that amazing? I came here giving away my last $10 and I leave rich. And that's just all you need. That's enough. That's enough. And so when you start to realize the laws, well, you don't realize the laws, but know that karma is this conditioning that we're doing all the time, then all we have to do is work out what is positive and what is negative. And so this is why I'm saying Buddhism, in a sense, can be simplified into just our actions. Just our actions. And once we really take on board the fact that karma is an actual occurrence in our lives, then we can really work with it. I was with someone the other day, a little girl, she was 9, and I'd gone to visit her mother, and we needed to get some milk. Mother had forgotten some milk. So I said to the little girl, she was Tibetan, and I said, Tashi, you come with me and we'll go to a shop. As we're walking up the road to my car, there was a bee struggling on the road. I went, whoops, stop. And I went over and I got a leaf, and she was saying, yeah, come on, save the bee. And here we were, forgetting all about the milk, no hurry, saving this bee and putting it on the grass. And I thought, isn't that fantastic? If all children had that same attitude of preserving life, of protecting life. There was a great sense of harmony, and there was a great mission for her and I to save the bee. In the bigger scope of the world, no big deal. For the bee, huge big deal. It wasn't going to get squashed. And just those little actions create positivity for our lives. And if we become very mindful, so one of the things I teach in my business courses, I teach meditation, but I say to the people that I'm teaching to, I said, it's not about meditation. Meditation is the tool. The result is mindfulness. We learn to be undistracted in meditation so that we become undistracted in life. If this little girl and I were walking up the road and we were unmindful or we weren't looking or whatever, maybe we killed the bee, the bee's life ends. But just being aware at that time was a really positive thing. Now, I'm not saying that I'm mindful all the time. I'm human like the rest of us. But just at that time, I was mindful and I looked down at the right time. And so if we develop this quality of mindfulness from our meditation, we are really looking after ourselves. There was, many years ago, there was an American poet who had, in the 1950s, and he'd written poetry, and he'd always been very interested in Eastern philosophy, and particularly Zen Buddhism. And a lot of his friends talked about it and discussed it, but then one day he decided he was not going to talk about it. He was going to Japan to live in a Zen monastery. And he lived there for 10 years practicing meditation. And when he came out, he was interviewed by a journalist. And the journalist asked, after 10 years, what is your practice? He said, oh, very simple. He said, I walk down the street and say, what are you doing now, mind? What are you thinking now, mind? That's mindfulness. Very simple. If you walk down the street and you say, what are you thinking now, mind? And you're thinking anger, mayhem, aggressiveness, miserliness, then you have the opportunity to change, right there and then. Mindfulness brings us into the present. It develops this quality of right view, the way we're thinking right now. Not, oh well, I'll be angry now and I'll be peaceful a little while later. Once a friend rang me and she said, she wasn't a Buddhist, and she said, oh, I've been really badly fired from my job. And she told me the story, and really quite unjustly. The boss above her wanted one of his friends to get the job, and then he made up a story and she got fired. And it was really quite appalling behaviour. And she was really furious because she was a very good worker and these lies had been told about her, and she lost her job. And I said, what are you going to do about it? She said, I'm so angry. So angry. I said, you know that's not going to work for you. She went, yes, I know. And I said, do you want to give it up? She said, can't I just have it for a couple more weeks? And I went, that's your choice, but ring me when you want to give it up. I have a wonderful way of giving it up. She went, okay. People hang on to that stuff. I mean, she could see that it was being ridiculous. She wanted to hang on to the anger for a little while longer. I said, is it making you feel good? She went, no way. I'm angry. And if we start to analyse our behaviour, we start to see how ridiculous it is, hanging on to anger and aggression. It harms us far more than others. And it does harm others as well. And if we harm others with our aggression and anger, we then have to pay for it in the laws of karma. Take what you want, but make sure you pay for it. That's actually an old Spanish saying. Take whatever you want, but make sure you pay for it, because you will have to. So if you know that, you can then start to look at your life and go, okay, I might just not hang on to this. And from a Buddhist perspective, which I didn't tell my friend about, is she had created the causes to be fired in a previous life, somewhere along the line. When my son Daniel was growing up, he'd get upset about something and I'd say, Daniel, you know, yeah, I know, I caused it, okay, all right, I'll drop it. Yeah, Dad giving him a hard time. Because we often feel like we want to be justifiably angry, don't we? We want to hang on to that little bit of grit sometimes because it feels tangible and it's justified. But if we're really taking the Buddhist path, we have to accept that we've created the causes in a previous life. I'll tell you a story that happened to me. And as I said, as I was explaining earlier, I like saying anecdotes. Many years ago, I worked for a couple of guys for a pharmaceutical company. And they had promised me that if I worked for them, they would reward me handsomely. So I actually put together a large treatment facility which dealt with chronic pain and stress. We had doctors, physiotherapists, and doctors, physiotherapists, and psychologists working on chronic pain problems. And these guys said, oh, look, we don't have much money, put it together. Once it's rolling, we'll look after you. So I worked for them for 12 months without pay, which meant I went through my own savings. And they kept saying, don't worry, don't worry. When it came to the time of payment, they didn't pay me. And I sat them down and I said, look, I've done this work and now you're not going to look after me. And they went, oh, well, that's the way it is. By the way, these two brothers were multimillionaires. And I said, but that's just not fair. I said, I've gone through most of my savings just to work for you. I put this facility together. And now you're not going to pay. And I went, no. The particular guy said to me, he said, oh, look, we'll look into it and we'll talk about it later. I left the facility then. And talk about it later. 18 years later, I still hadn't got a phone call. Meanwhile, I had let it go. I realised that the karma that was happening to me had been a result of a previous life, that it was unfortunate, and I was probably a bit naive going into a business venture without a signed contract, but I did trust these guys. And 18 years later, a couple of people knew about it, people who knew these guys. A couple of years later, I was going to a party sorry, 18 years later, I was going to a party, and someone said, oh, do you know this guy's going to be there, the one that did this? And I said, yeah, I have heard. He said, how are you going to treat him? I said, absolutely fine. He said, but will you talk to him? I said, yeah, I'll talk to him. I said, if he brings up the subject, I'll say that he owes me a lot of money if we want a business discussion. But I said, I doubt whether he'll do that. And I met him at the party, and this guy was very hesitant. He saw me. And he came over and he shook my hand. I said, oh, hi, how you doing? His wife actually came over to me and she said, have you forgiven us? I said, yeah, completely. I honestly didn't hang on to it. Now, I'm not a walking saint or anything. I just realised that hanging on to a situation, these guys were never going to pay me. In fact, the other brother said, yeah, well, you can try and get it out of us, but we'll have you in court for 10 years. So he was a bit more ruthless, which would probably have been the truth. And I didn't have a contract, so it would have gone nowhere, and I would have spent more money, and I couldn't afford it. But the truth of it is, I really honestly took it on board and said, okay, I'm just going to have to let this go. And in fact, what I did was an actual practice where I visualised giving them the money as a present, because I didn't want the baggage. Now, okay, it made my lifestyle a little bit more difficult at the time, but I honestly don't have a difficult lifestyle now. Those guys have to live with it if they have to live with it. The fact that the wife even came to me and said, oh, look, have you forgiven us, means that she was carrying something around. And I was free of it. And it was a really clear way that I had got from my teachers on not hanging on to stuff. When negative stuff happens to you, that is a result of previous karma. The right view is that karma exists, and if it's happening to you, you must at some stage let it go. And stuff like that happens. When the Dalai Lama interviewed some monks that had been imprisoned by the communist Chinese for 20 years and gone through a very difficult time, the one monk said to him, and the Dalai Lama said he was very moved, he said, what was your greatest fear? He said, my greatest fear was that I might lose compassion for my torturers. That is such a powerful statement, to be in the midst of experiencing torture and to fear, not fear the pain or the degradation or whatever, but to actually fear that you might lose compassion for your captors. So we can hear these stories, and there are many, many, many stories of people within Buddhism that have used the technologies, the understandings of the Buddha, to achieve, in this sense, right view and wisdom. So that's the first noble truth. Any questions? Yes. In other words, it's like predetermined.
Yes.
Yeah.
Why would they want to?
Why could you change? Yeah.
Yeah,
very good question. Thank you. This is a good question. Every moment you are experiencing is a result of previous karma. Every intersection of that moment is a choice to create new karma. You always have the choice. So yes, you're experiencing now at this very moment. This very moment is a result of previous karma. And at this very moment is a choice to create new karma. We're always at the crossroads. We are always at the crossroads. We're at the crossroads of intersecting karma in every second, in every nanosecond. According to Buddhist thought, every 65 moments to a finger snap, we're enjoying karma, or not. And so at that point, that was a great question. At that point, we then have the choice. So when something negative is happening, we have the choice to respond in a negative way and create more karma, or we have the choice to respond in a positive way and create more karma. If you want a negative person to not show up again, if you want an angry person not to show up again, don't be angry back. If you want a person who's giving you a hard time not to show up again, don't give them a hard time, because you've just created the causes for them to show up in your life, maybe not even this life, maybe in another life, as someone that's going to give you a hard time. But don't do it. We have the choice right every single moment. And this is where mindfulness comes into play. Mindfulness is about being present to the present. Knowing what your mind is doing right now. Now, at first that seems like a huge chore. But gradually through the practice of Buddhism and through the practice of meditation, understanding the teachings, but particularly through meditation, you start to achieve a sense of quietness. And in that quietness is the chance to be present to what's going on. And in that quietness, you have the choice of creating what you want for the future. The next four of the Eighth Noble Path is about ethical conduct. So, right intention. Right intention can be described as the commitment to ethical and mental improvement, self-improvement. Okay? So it's the commitment to decide to walk this attitude of self-improvement. One Lama said many years ago, he said, you have two choices in life. Either be completely ignorant and stay that way, or if you have a little bit of wisdom, you have to get enlightened. No choice. Either be completely ignorant or go for the positive, right path. Seems logical. I'm going to ask a controversial question. Does anyone struggle here with their Buddhism? Does anyone struggle sometimes with the right view, the right way to go? Because within life, there are many grey areas. There's ethical behaviour that is very grey. A friend of mine, I'll give you an example, a friend of mine was talking to a Buddhist teacher, and he said, I was in a very difficult position. He said, I had a cat with a tick in its neck. And he said, if I take the tick out, I will probably kill it. If I don't take the tick out, the cat will die. What will I do? And the Buddhist teacher said, well, what did you do? He said, well, I tried to take the tick out, but it died. He said, what was your motivation? What was your intention? He said, my intention was to save my cat. He said, then within that situation, that was the best that you could do at that time. He didn't want to kill the tick, but he also wanted to save his cat. And these are the areas where we come across difficulties, and we have to really focus on our intention, our motivation in that situation. And the teacher said, well, that's the best you can do. When we drive a car, we probably kill many insects. So what do? Don't drive cars. Don't eat food. Don't breathe. They reckon every one of us in our lifetime swallowed about 10 spiders. Sounds terrible, doesn't it? Give you all nightmares. But we don't have the opportunity. There was, in the early days of Buddhism, when Buddhism first came to Tibet, the king of Tibet invited, this is about the 7th century, 8th century, invited two practitioners to come to Tibet. One was Indian and one was Chinese. The Chinese guy was Huashan, Shantira Shankar, I think was the name of the other one. I can't remember his full name. But the Indian practitioner came and the Chinese practitioner came. And he got them to sit down and give a week's discourse on their method. And Huashan said, well, any movement of the mind creates karma. Karma actually means movement or action. So he said, any movement of the mind will create action. So therefore, I suggest that you work on not moving the mind at all. Making the mind completely still without any intention going in any direction. That is the way to enlightenment. And the Indian teacher said, nah. He said, I believe that you should work constantly for good and for the benefit of others. So the debate raged backwards and forwards, and in the end the king of the Tibet said, well, if you don't do anything, that may be okay for you, but you're not doing anything for anybody else either. You are living the life of a block of wood. You may achieve high states of realization, maybe, you may not, but you're actually not doing any benefit to anyone else. We will adopt this other gentleman's idea that even though he will make many mistakes, his intention is right. And that's the important thing. We will all make mistakes. In fact, it's been said that if all bodhisattvas gave up when they made a mistake, there would be no Buddhas. So there's hope for all of us. When we make a mistake, we recognize it. When we make a mistake, we don't develop guilt around that. Guilt is like sitting in the car and not turning the engine on. The better way of looking at a mistake is intelligent regret. Understanding that you have created a negative action due to ignorance, lack of wisdom, whatever it may be, and going, that didn't work, or I spoke badly to that person, I've created, that didn't work, I won't do that again. That's called intelligent regret. And that's the way we build our lives towards positive action. All good intentions come out of experience, and experience comes out of bad intentions. In other words, the more mistakes we make, if we develop wisdom around that, we can say, okay, well, we won't do that again. That didn't work. When we've gossiped about somebody and then it comes back, then we have a problem. So therefore we go, okay, well, maybe it's better not to say negative things about people. Sometimes it's better to keep your mouth shut. And I'll tell you a story of this, of a guy I knew who was a photographer. And he said that he couldn't stop saying the wrong thing. He said, I am born with my foot in my mouth. He said, I cannot do anything but say the wrong thing. He said, I'll walk into a shop and say to the lady, when are you expecting? And she'll say, I'm not. He said, why do I do that? He had a distinct lack of mindfulness. He said, but the worst situation was when he was a young, budding photographer. This is in the days before digital cameras. None of us remember it. When we had film. When there was actually a thing called film. And they'd taken some photographs. And he's in the dark room developing these photographs. And it's sort of a bridal party. And he goes, oh my God, look at that woman. She is so ugly. And the boss standing behind him says, that's my daughter. And he goes, no, 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 no. The woman behind her, he said, that's my mother. That's called digging a hole you can't get out of. Now, in that situation, if he knew that he had problems with that, it would have been really mindful not to say anything. But he couldn't help himself. So be careful who you criticise when you see the photo. It doesn't work. Anyway, I never knew what happened to him. I hope he went on a silent retreat for many years. Okay. Right speech. Again, this is what I'm talking about here. I'm bringing that example in. The importance of speech in the Buddhist ethics is obvious. Words can break or save lives, make enemies or friends, start war or create peace. Buddha explained right speech as follows. To abstain from false speech, especially not to tell deliberate lies and not to speak deceitfully. To abstain from slanderous speech and to use words maliciously against others. To abstain from harsh words that offend or hurt others, and to abstain from idle chatter that lacks purpose or depth. Positively phrased, this means to tell the truth, to speak friendly, warm and gently, and talk really when necessary. So that's pretty obvious. We know that things that we say can cause problems. And I think, as I mentioned before, one of the biggest problems is gossip, where we talk about people. Now, gossip can be just discussing a situation, or gossip can be where we have the intention of talking to someone about somebody to colour their opinion of that person. Oh, what do you think of so-and-so? Oh, they're pretty honest. Yeah, they're quite honest. Those kinds of conversation don't seem very powerful, but in the end we're colouring that person's intention, or the way that they viewed it. And our view may be really, really, really biased. We hear about people talking about other people and going, oh, well, that person's like that. Have you met them? Oh, no, but I'm sure they're like that. And then when they meet them, they're completely different. We all have our own perspective. Interestingly enough, that perspective is related to our karma. If we see someone as negative, that's due to our karma. And everyone will have a different opinion. You'll think someone is a completely awful person. Their mother thinks they're just wonderful. Who is right? Who knows? So we have to be careful what we say about people, and we have to be careful what we say to people. I was in a situation many years ago where I was giving a massage to this lady, very wealthy lady. I'm sure I've told you this one before. I think last time we were here. And the phone rang. Right? Remember that one? And the phone rang and she said, tell them I'm not here. Hello, I'm the burglar. She's not here. I said, but you are here. She said, yeah, but tell them I'm not here. I said, well, who do I tell them I am? I'm the masseur. Well, where's the lady of the house? What are you massaging? The dog. Do you see how complicated it gets? And I said to her, I said, we've got two choices. I can pick up the phone and say you're busy, or we don't pick up the phone. And she had this bright smile. She went, why don't we not pick up the phone? I said, there you go. I said, problem solved. I think in Buddhism that's called skillful means. We avoided the situation, and that's quite valid. It's okay to avoid a situation as long as you realise that you're not being deceitful. And it was going to be complicated. She actually didn't want people to know she was having a massage for whatever reason. So, you know, that was fine. And so the more that you start to understand the right intention, the right speech, and then the right action. And the right action refers to the deeds involved bodily actions. Unwholesome actions lead to unsound states of mind, while wholesome actions lead to states of mind, sound states of mind. Think about gangsters. People that are involved in constant criminal behaviour. Their whole lives are in agitation. They're worried about the next gangster taking their territory. They're worried about being caught by the police. They're constantly in a state of agitation, of looking over their shoulders. If they get caught, they can get sent to jail. If they get sent to jail, there's people in jail that have rival gangs or whatever and cause them suffering. So any deeds that you create are going to have an effect on your life. And if those deeds are in a big criminal way, you've got a lot of baggage to carry around. Why would you want to carry all that stuff around? Why would you want to be involved where life and the money that you have is always in jeopardy of being taken from you? Always fearful. You remember a number of years ago, see you later, take care. A number of years ago in I think it was New Zealand, where a bank accidentally put $10 million into, you remember, was it 10 mil? Something like that. Yeah. That ad actually added noughts onto the $10,000 or whatever, and they'd put this money into this couple's bank account, and they went, right. And they were gone out of the country within minutes. Chased all over the world by Interpol. Could you imagine? You've got 10 million bucks going, well, where are we going to hide? Oh, don't sit on that beach. Oh, don't go there. I mean, what torture. Constantly wondering, what's that? Room service? Oh, is it really room service? Can you imagine what kind of a life you'd be leading? And they got caught and they ended up in jail. Bingo. One prisoner said, if you want to see whether you're a genius, go to jail. You'll be smarter than everybody else there. Not necessarily. So those kinds of actions just do not lead to pleasant life. You know, we really all want happiness. We absolutely want happiness. And as my teacher said, we want happiness and many people run to suffering. There's happiness. Whoa, we'll go this way. A girl once came to me for counselling. And she said, I wanted to discuss this with you. I said, what's that? She said, I met this wonderful guy. He's just unbelievably spiritual. He's so together, he's intelligent, he's wise. I said, oh, that's fantastic. I'm thinking, why is she coming to talk? She said, there's only one little problem. I said, what's that? She said, he's married with two children. I went, hold it, let's rewind this. He's spiritual, he's intelligent, he's wise. And he's a liar and a cheat. She didn't add those two bits to it. I said, hold it. No, I'm sorry. If you ever came to me for counselling, the first thing I say to people when they walk through the door is, I'm not a psychologist, I'm not a psychiatrist, and I will give you an opinion. It's up to you whether you take it or not. I won't sit here, I will give you an opinion. I said, that man is complete rubbish. If he is cheating on his wife, he's cheating on you, he's cheating on his two children. I said, whenever you go out with him, or whenever you're with him, just imagine wife and the two kiddies standing there watching. Sure, that's a horrible idea. I said, that's exactly the truth of it. The man is not spiritual, and he doesn't have wisdom, and he is causing suffering to you in the future, and to his wife and to his two kids. I said, has he talked about leaving his wife? Oh no, he doesn't want to do that. So you're a second class citizen. And I heard of a worse case, actually, where a gentleman, very high up in the business world, has a wife and four children. It's in this city, I won't use names. In this city, with a wife and four children, and a mistress with a 10-year-old daughter. He's been with this woman for 12 or 13 years. The wife and the four kids don't know. And twice a week, he picks the daughter up and takes it. Once he takes it to school, this is the other daughter. And then another night, he has dinner with them. Can you imagine what this 10-year-old girl is going to grow up like? That she's in the second-class family. That she, her daddy isn't there the whole time because he is another family. Now, how that gets explained when she's 15, 16, 18 or 20, I have no idea. But he's not leaving his wife, and this other woman's very well looked after because she's getting lots of money from this guy. He's very wealthy. But the suffering that he's creating for six people, seven, four kids, his wife, and himself, and the other two. Just to create, sorry, I was doing maths. that's my big bit. That's what I'm good at. So anyway, the point being is that in the end, everybody suffers from his one action and the acceptance of the mistress and the acceptance of what he's created there. And one day it's going to go boom. And they may all walk. And he'll be by himself and he'll say, well, what have I created? Well, I've got lots of money, but I've created this extraordinary suffering. And no matter how powerful and intelligent this man may be, there is no wisdom. And this is something we've also got to work out. I'm going to use this phrase. Data is not information. Information is not knowledge. And knowledge is not necessarily wisdom. Did you get that? Data is not information. Information is not necessarily knowledge. And knowledge is not necessarily wisdom. What do you think is the difference between knowledge and wisdom?
Wisdom is applied knowledge.
Exactly. Beautiful. Thank you. That was quick. It's what you do with it is wisdom. What you do with it. There is no point being a scholar of incredible information and then not using it. And unfortunately, according to the prediction of the Buddha, in the last the Buddha's teachings are meant to last for 5,000 years. We've got 2,500 years to go, so don't fret. It's okay. You've got time, a little bit of time. You don't waste it. In the last 500 years of the Buddha's teaching, it is said that Buddha's teachings will be books in a dusty library. Probably discs in a dusty library of some variety. Forget about the books. And that scholars will read this quaint ancient knowledge, but due to the causes and conditions of the karma of the people born in the last 500 years of Buddhism, in around that time, there won't be any realizations. And the next phase from wisdom is actually realization. Realization is different to wisdom in the fact that there is no thought involved. It's a complete... I guess the analogy would be, when we grow up, we're taught that fire is hot. So gradually over time, through experiencing ouch, we start to realize that fire is hot. And when we see an element on a stove glowing, we don't have to go, it's like a realization. We absolutely know, without a shadow of a doubt, without any conjecture, almost without thought, that putting a hand on that is going to be excruciatingly painful. And so, in a sense, once we work with wisdom long enough, it becomes a realization. And this is really where the great masters have had no doubt with compassion. There's not a situation of, oh, it's good to be compassionate in this situation, but compassion just comes spontaneously. There's no thought. And according to Buddhist understanding, the Buddha doesn't think. The Buddha knows. And in some of the teachings that I've had on the extraordinary qualities of the Buddha, it's one that I often talk to people who aren't Buddhists, and I say to them, oh, I had an enlightening experience the other day. I said, well, in Buddhism, enlightenment has a very, very special quality. And they go, oh, what's that? What's that? What's the enlightenment of a Buddha? I said, well, just one of the qualities is the Buddha knows the past, present, and future of every being in every universe all at the one moment. And they go, whoa, that's incredible. And that's the capacity of a Buddha, is to know, not think. The Buddha's mind is omniscient. The Buddha's mind is everywhere all at the one moment. Now, Buddhist joke. What's something a Buddha can't do? If a Buddha's mind is everywhere all at the one moment, what's something a Buddha can't do? Get lost. Okay, impossible. If you're everywhere, you can't get lost. So there's some limitations. okay, where are we going for time? I've plenty of time. So the actions of right actions are abstaining from harming sentient beings as much as possible, looking after sentient beings. Now, I've thrown this, I don't know if I've thrown this conundrum to you. I know I have done it with this class. you come across a spider web, and an ant has crawled into the spider web. Do you save the ant, or do you leave the ant there? Okay, who's for saving the ant? Who's for leaving the ant there? Okay. And that question was put to me when I first did a Buddhist course in 1978. And I'm going, the spider needs to eat, and the ant needs to be free, and maybe I shouldn't interfere with nature. And so the monk answered it, which I thought was great. He said, you've just become part of the equation. If you're not there, you're not part of the equation. He said, if you save the ant, the spider will be a bit hungry, but you've saved the ant's life. But the spider won't die from missing out on one ant. So he said, you're part of the equation, why don't you say, unless it was completely wrapped up, I'm saying it was just caught, okay? I'm not saying that the ant couldn't move and it was like, you'd have to pull the web off on its legs. There's not much you can do then. Poor ant. But the ant's just walked into the web and it's struggling. And the spider's about, if you save the ant, yes, the spider will be not happy, missed out on breakfast. But it's a spider, trust me, it'll get some more food when you're not there. And you can't stand there all day going, nah, nah. That doesn't work either. That's crazy. So you save the ant. And I went, yeah, that's reasonable. I can get that. That's a reasonable way of looking after things, because I've become part of the equation. When I'm not there, I can't do anything about it. And that's where you have to start looking at things like that. And I just thought this monk's view was really clear, and I thought that was really logical. He just went step by step through it. And that's where you can do the right action, by just starting to understand. And if your intention is never to harm sentient beings, then that's what you try to do as much as possible. Will you harm sentient beings? Absolutely. You've got big feet, you'll step on something and injure it somehow. But if you, as much as possible, try to avoid harming, then you will do the best you can. And I was in a Jewish household one time when I was doing massage, and the guy was on the table and he finished the massage and he got up and there was a cockroach running across the floor and he went to step on it and his wife pushed him back and said, no, Rod will get it, he's a Buddhist. Oh, great. So I saved the cockroach, but I just thought it was amazing. I hadn't really talked to them about Buddhism at all. I guess I must have mentioned it. But she was mindful enough to actually protect that cockroach because I was in the place. I thought that was incredible. Yeah, and I picked the cockroach up, took him outside. And that happens to my son at work. He works for he's an editor in a company. And the company knows that he's a Buddhist. He doesn't make a big deal of it. But someone said, oh yeah, whenever there's a spider or bug in the office, we call Daniel to take it out. Us Buddhists have become bug collectors. But fair enough. But the fact is that these people would normally destroy it, and yet they're going on. And isn't it interesting that an innate quality in people is that they don't want to kill, really. They really don't want to see animals die. It's even, forget about philosophy, it's kind of a quality in us that we don't really want to see things suffer. I was at a Dharma course many years ago with very famous Sogyal Rinpoche. And we're in a temple that he'd created up at Myer Lakes. And I was standing next to this guy. He'd obviously just come that day or in a couple of days. And we're standing and there's all the holy objects and, you know, Buddha there and everything, and he goes, swats a mosquito. And I really spontaneously said, oh, don't do that. He said, why? I said, they don't want to die. Their life's precious. And I went, just kind of popped out. And then I walked away And I could just see him standing there for a moment. I thought, oh, you know, couldn't help it. That's just really a spontaneous reaction to that. The next day, he came up to me. He said, look, I really want to thank you for that. He said, I thought about that all night. He said, you're absolutely right. I went, wow. And that was just such a powerful moment for me to be spontaneous, and he got it. You know? Put on some bug repellent. You know? As much as possible, we have this constant opportunity to not harm life. We can catch the bugs. I'm great at catching cockroaches. I'll tell you a really good method for a cockroach, okay? Oh, you're all feeling a bit creepy, are you? You get a glass, right? Cockroaches always run ahead. And they've got shocking eyesight. I know, because I've tested this. So, if you try to shove a glass over a cockroach, you've got a good chance of squashing it. So this is the method works fabulous. Works for spiders too, but you've got to be a little bit braver. So you get a bigger glass container. A clear container. Are you all with me here? You put the container there and you go, right? And you go straight in. Got him outside. Spiders do the same thing. They run. Obviously, if there's a noise there, they're not going to go towards the noise. They're really smart like that. And they will run away from it. So if you've got a clear container in front of them, they're going to go straight into it. Works every time. Particularly big spiders. Do you know the hardest ones, though? You know those little lizards, the skinks? Seen those little ones? They're impossible. They can see glass. Like... Anyway, that's right action, not harm.
Another method for you for
the lizard. The what, sorry?
For the lizard, I'll tell you a method later.
Another method? Yes. Oh, no, tell us now. Come on.
Well, you can catch them if you take a thread, like a fishing thread.
Oh, yeah.
And you make a little note, one of those notes that you can pull on it gets tight.
Yeah.
You just put it at the end of a real piece of stick or something, and you can basically take that loop around their head. They can feel it.
Really?
I used to do that when I was a kid.
And it doesn't harm them?
No, but it gets a bit tight. But then
yeah, it's like a collar.
Take it off.
There you go. There's another method. That's for the little lizards. there's wisdom coming out everywhere.
That was an exchange for sharing the Spider-Man.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Abstaining from taking what is not given, which includes stealing, robbery, fraud, deceitfulness, and dishonesty. So yes, you know, if someone walks into a pub and they're offering you a hot deal on something, it's probably stolen. Best not to do it. It's prosecutable anyway. Like that guy, did you see the guy at McDonald's that picked up $11,000? I didn't hear about that story. It was in the papers. This guy, there was $11,000 in a bag, sitting in a bag in McDonald's. And the guy walked over to it and went, out the door. CCTV cameras, all works. They got him. And they said, well, what were you doing? He said, oh, well, I figured it was just left there. And he said, I thought it might have been probably from some illicit gains. In other words, I think the guy's a robber that had this money, so therefore I'll take it. I wonder where the robber got it from. Hold it, someone's missing out here if it was a robber. Anyway, he took the money, shown on camera, and when they got him, he got prosecuted, and his defence was, well, I didn't keep all the money myself, I shared it with my friends, so I'm not that dishonest. That was his excuse. The judge said that was not an excuse for stealing the money, being generous with money that you don't own. And he ended up getting, I think he got a fine, he didn't go to jail. But, you know, why didn't he just hand it in? It caused him so much more grief, and he got fined. He lost his 11 grand that he stole, and he ended up having to pay a fine, and he got a criminal record, which he said might affect his studies or future travel to other countries. So dumb, you know, really not smart. And so the more we look at right and wrong action, we start to see that when we start to do things, funnily enough, illegally, but even morally wrong, it's going to cause us more grief. And so the road to happiness is not necessarily following our desires. That's the quote for the day, okay, for the evening. Following your desires is not necessarily the road to happiness or freedom. Okay, so, and this is, in a sense, right action is really to do with precepts. Many, many precepts. And I remember asking a friend of mine that became a Buddhist monk, and in the Tibetan tradition there's 256 vows. And I went, how is it that you've got all those restrictions? He said, they free me because I don't have to think. I just keep them and then I don't have to worry about anything. So, and then particularly, which is right speech, with lying. If you don't tell a lie, then you don't have to have a good memory. The more lies you tell, the more memories you have to store up there of fake situations. A friend of mine was having to, he was married to a Catholic woman. It was kind of a complicated situation. And the new husband wanted the marriage annulled in the Catholic Church so that he could marry in the Catholic Church with her, because she wasn't meant to be divorced. And so he was asked by the ex-wife, and back again. Oh, we thought we'd lost you for good. And he was asked by the wife to go to a priest and talk about the marriage. And if the marriage was a loveless marriage, then they could annul the marriage. And he said, well, it wasn't. I said, well, then your only option is to tell the truth. Just tell the truth. The absolute truth of what that experience was. And he went to the priest, and the priest questioned him all these questions, and the priest said, oh, well, so you've told the truth, and therefore there's difficulties involved with the marriage. Now, the ex-wife and the new husband, or the new prospective husband, were very furious at my brother. And he said, well, what could I do? I said, look, if you lie, you're going to create much more of a situation. And in the end, they got married anyway, it was fine, and you know, it wasn't so radical, because over time things got left out. But I think in all situations, we really do have to know that telling the truth is the right action. However, sometimes, and this is with my own teacher, I've asked my teacher a question, and he's looked at me and said, I'm not telling you the answer. He didn't lie, he just said, no, I'm not telling you the answer to that. I said, oh, should I do this, or should I do that? And he went, no, not telling you. And I thought, wow, that's just a really clear option. Just not going to tell you. And you do have that option. Okay, moving on to right livelihood. Right livelihood means that one should earn one's living in a righteous way, that wealth should be gained legally and peacefully. So, obviously, arms dealing is not a peaceful way of living one's life. Slave, prostitution, all those things of... And interestingly enough, it's not the prostitution that is actually the negative, it's the living off making someone a prostitute that becomes the problem. Of right livelihood. Okay, it's not the action of the individual, it's where someone is, and particularly enslaving someone into prostitution is an extremely obviously negative way of living your life. But any selling intoxicants, poisons and drugs and things, you know, causing grief to other people. Right livelihood means that really any kind of business that is involved harming other beings, that's consequences harm other beings. In terms of that, if you meet someone in the street that is begging for money and you think they're going to use it to harm themselves, should you give them the money? if you really think this person is a drug addict and they're going to go out and get more heroin or whatever, then you really have to make a decision no. And I've been in that situation where someone was really off the planet asking for money. I said, no, I'm sorry, I'm not going to give it to you. But funnily enough, that's pretty rare. Yep. If they want to go, you can't, come on, I'm, listen, I won't give you 10 cents, but I'm taking you to the rehab centre. But the other, it's a good point though, the other one though, is that you may decide to buy them food, if they're begging for food. However, a friend of mine did that, and he got an extremely bad reaction from the woman sitting on the ground. She went, money, I want food. So he went away and bought her back food, and she went, oh! She was actually begging for money for alcohol. She's an alcoholic. So she was pretending to beg for food, so he took her literally and bought her food, and she was like, just chucked it away. So, yeah. But you do the, again, these are the grey areas, but really, if you saw someone, you know, but if possible, 90% of people need money. Give them some money. You know? A couple of dollars here, a couple of dollars there. Really, really doesn't affect our lifestyle, and it may help them a little bit. There was, when I went to India, in 2006 to the Buddhist monasteries, Tibetan Buddhist monasteries in South India, south of Bangalore, about 2.5 hours. And these monasteries are huge. They've got 3,000-4,000 monks living there. It's quite incredible. To be surrounded by 4,000 Buddhist practitioners is really quite an extraordinary thing. And the thing that I noticed, they were incredibly happy. Really happy, smiling all the time. They were well fed, they were able to do their practices. Little kids were looked after, so they were having a really good time, from what I understood. But there was one guy that I noticed, and he was a Hindu, obviously a Hindu, and he was, and because this monastery is so big, it's like there's roads going, you know, roads everywhere between the compounds and the temples and whatever. And this one guy, I noticed he had no fingers gone, so it must have been leprosy. And he was sitting down, and he was always smiling with his one tooth. He had one tooth for a smile, and he had his hand out for money, and we'd go past and give him money. And I found out his story later. It's quite amazing. He had arrived leprosy and blind to this monastery, had nothing. And immediately they said, yeah, no, you can stay here and beg for money if there's any tourists going past. And the monks gave money. Not only that, they would bring out food for him. And one of the monks, which was such a sweet thing, offered to give the beggar one of his eyes. Now, they had to tell the monk that they hadn't perfected eye transplants at that stage, so that wouldn't work. But he genuinely asked if there was a possibility to donate one eye to the beggar, which is just incredible, incredible compassion. But in the end, the beggar, through the nutrition, started to regain some eyesight. His eyesight started to come back, so he could start to see, not well, but enough that he wasn't totally blind. They built him a little house. I saw his little house. It was only about this big. And he ended up making money, enough money that one of the senior monks actually had to put a bank account out for him. And because it was also a pretty rough area of India, their robbers would sometimes come through, and so they made sure that his money was put in a bank, and he was, from his begging, he would give it all to the Lama, and he would do the bank entries for him and give him a weekly allowance. So he actually had a job. So he got well fed. Here was a man in the worst possible situation in India, having the extraordinary karma to end up in this Buddhist monastery and be looked after. And the local Hindu population, Indian population, said they were just so delighted with the Tibetan monastery being there, because this area of India was very poor, the ground was not good, and it was pretty much jungle, a few wild elephants and things. And they said that the Buddhist monastery going there had made them prosperous, because they needed Indian labour to help build the monastery, so they got employed. They needed food, so the local farmers started growing food for the monastery. And there was this wonderful, and then the taxi drivers came, the taxi drivers will come everywhere, to ferry people around. And so there was this wonderful connection with the Tibetans and the Indians, where everyone was supporting everybody, and they had this wonderful kind of existence. And this poor old beggar was well looked after. So, you know, there was a wonderful situation where, in a sense, right livelihood for this poor beggar. In the past, maybe some very negative karma that he created. But in the end, and he was really nice to people, and he was kind to people in his own way. He would thank them, and if they gave him money, he would say, much blessings to you in Hindi. So he was doing the best he could with his job. Right effort. Mental energy is the force behind right effort. It can occur in either wholesome or unwholesome states. The same type of energy that fuels desire, envy, aggression and violence can be on the other side fuel self-discipline, honesty, belovedness and kindness and generosity. So this energy, this mental energy, we can have right intention in a sense, or this energy to continually do the right thing. So, oh look, I was generous once, I don't feel like doing it twice. It's not necessarily the right way to think. It's this continual desire for positive action and positive attitudes and positive relationships. My teacher would sometimes, and I wasn't there at the time, but he would go shopping with a supermarket trolley in the full Buddhist robes, and he'd go supermarket shopping for the Buddhist centre. He'd do the shopping, help with the shopping. And one of the guys going with him one time, he was going through the aisles and he said, "Don't worry everybody, I'm a good pilot." You know, he'd make people crack up and just create some lightness. And my friend said he was standing there one day and my old teacher looked across and saw this old lady really struggling with a trolley. And he just stopped. He just walked over to her and he took her hand and just said, "Are you okay?" And she looked up and she said, "Yes, thank you for asking." That was all, nothing more. He wasn't giving her money or whatever. He was just inquiring as to her health. And my friend said, it was maybe the first time in months or years that this lady, someone actually went out of their way to go to this woman and say, "Are you okay?" Just that action. But he said, he didn't do it. He said, the Lama did it. He went out of his way to do that. Just take her hand and said, "Are you okay?" That's enough. That's a huge action, and that may have changed that whole lady's day, or it may have brightened her life. Just the fact that some stranger actually cared. And quite often we get a bit shy and we don't think that we can do stuff. That we think I better not help there. But you'd be surprised how many opportunities, if you're mindful, come up in a day where you can be of help to someone. Except the situation with me where I didn't quite, and this was a lack of wisdom in my part and a lack of understanding. I was walking down Oxford Street in the city, Paddington. And it was quite busy, and there was a woman walking along with a white cane, and she dropped something on the floor, on the ground. And quick as a flash, I picked it up. And I didn't realise that I didn't talk to her and say, touch her and say, "Oh look, I'll pick that up for you." I just naturally, because you pick things up for people, I didn't tell her. So she bent down looking for it and I'm going, "Oh no." And she got quite angry. She said, "Don't you understand, blind people can't see your intentions." And I went, "Oh no." I said, "Oh look, I'm really sorry." She said, "In future, if a blind person drops something, tell them that you're going to pick it up for them. Don't just do it." And I went, "Thank you for that. Really, I do appreciate that. That's something some information that I just didn't think about." And I thought, okay, that's great. So occasionally our intentions don't come off exactly the way we want them to. But the lesson I got out of that was worth it. The fact that I know now that if a blind person drops something, tell them you're going to pick it up. Don't just go. They're not going to see that action. Okay? So this is being available at all times. And again, my teacher, we're coming, this is going back many years, We'd gone to Flemington Markets in Melbourne, and we're walking down through this pit where all the butchers are, and they've got I don't think it's like that now. It's just sawdust. Have you ever been there? It's just sawdust. It was sawdust on the ground, and this, you know, it didn't look great. It was like a hell room. There's carcasses hanging up, and all these guys are covered in blood and aprons, and it was really quite messy. My teacher was walking through there, and one of the butchers grabbed him on the arm and went, "Where are you from?" Like slapped him. And it was beautiful to watch. My teacher just spontaneously, in the same energy, slapped him back. He said, "I from Tibet, where are you from?" Not, "Oh, what did you touch me for? You're covered in blood." Or it was no reaction like that. Completely spontaneously. "I from Tibet, where are you from?" In the end, there were about five butchers standing around joking and jostling, and here's my teacher in the middle of it. And he said, "Got to go now," and we're going. And I turn around, and these guys are like, it was the most beautiful thing. He just charmed these guys, you know, just didn't criticize them for being butchers or wrong livelihood or whatever. Just connected with human beings at their level. We walk straight out of Flemington Markets, and there's a woman in a Mercedes-Benz pulling boxes out of the back seat. And he runs. Now, she's beautifully dressed, you know, compared to the butchers, very differently dressed. He just runs to this lady and he pulls out all the boxes and puts them on the sidewalk, and then he walks off. I didn't do anything. She turns to me and says, "Oh, thank you." I say, "Oh, no problem." I didn't do anything. He was so far spontaneously with helping people. It was like he was watching the whole time for some opportunity to be a benefit. And that's the quality of someone who was a great meditator and someone who had extraordinary mindfulness. Just to be present. Not on a big, he didn't give them sermons or, you know, tell them they should be Buddhists or convert them. There's nothing about that. It was just about genuine human kindness at the interface of what people needed, being absolutely available for whatever happened. And the most miraculous one, I'll tell you, which I heard from one of my friends who was, it was Christmas Eve in Melbourne, and my teacher had said he wanted to go and buy some presents for people at the centre. So my friend took him into town, and they were coming out of the department store, and down a few hundred yards away was this mighty brawl happening outside of a pub. People punching each other in really serious fight. And my teacher said to the attendant, "You stay here, stupid people, sentient beings, harming themselves." And he goes straight towards the fight. Oh my God. And my friend's going, "Oh no." And he said, unbelievable. The moment he arrives, they all stop and run away. He says, like, what did he do? Stupid sentient beings harming themselves was his comment. And he said there was absolutely no fear. No fear of his life. How many of us would run towards a brawl to stop it? I mean, unbelievable, but there was just nothing that stopped him stopping sentient beings, stupid sentient beings. And as he said, he got there and they all just stopped and ran away. So perfect action. Okay, so that's right off effort, having the right attitude and abandoning unwholesome states of mind. Number 7, right mindfulness. Right mindfulness is anchored in clear perception and penetrates impressions without getting carried away. Right mindfulness enables us to be aware of the process of conceptualization in the way that we actively observe and control the way our thoughts go. So that's really what we've been talking about all along, this right mindfulness, having our minds being present. Most of the accidents we have in our car, apart from when we're texting, is distraction. That's distraction. Speeding, alcohol, and distraction is the cause of all accidents. So mindfulness takes care of that distraction. So we can avoid a heap of problems in our lives by being mindful. So that's right mindfulness. The Buddha accounted this in the four foundations of mindfulness: contemplation of the body, contemplation of feeling, active or neutral, contemplation of the state of mind, and contemplation of the phenomena, external phenomena. And then finally, right concentration. In this context, described as one-pointedness of mind, meaning a state where all mental faculties are unified and directed onto one particular object. So this is, in a sense, concentration. This is the develop through meditation, developing this concentration. The opposite of concentration is distraction. So by developing states of mind through meditation, and it's important when you meditate to actually meditate. There's always a temptation to go, oh yeah, well I'll just think about this for a while and then I'll meditate. Stop, do the thinking, then meditate. In other words, if you practice being distracted in your meditation, that's what you'll develop. So I often say in my class at my Buddha Center, we finish off with a meditation and I say, right, we're going to meditate on the breath for 5 minutes. This may be the last meditation you will ever do. Who knows when the time of death is coming? They all look at me going, oh my God, misery. But it's true. It might be the last meditation you ever do. You do not know the time of your passing. It is uncertain. It's definite it'll happen. So make every meditation the most important. And one of the other things about the mind too is, and this is known as throwing karma, the state of mind you have before you die is the state of existence you will have when you'll be reborn. So when you're driving your car and you are very angry and using strange hand signals at people, if you die by being hit by a truck, you will end up in the hell of bad hand signals for the next life. So it's important to maintain wherever you want, to maintain a positive state of mind, because if you die in an anguish state of mind, your next rebirth isn't so good. So it's important to maintain this attitude. And it doesn't have to be rigid and negative, it can be really happy and relaxed. You know, the greatest practitioners I've met, the greatest Buddhas and Buddhist teachers I've met, are really happy. They have really happy states of mind. Once I asked my teacher, I said, do you suffer? He said, oh no, I don't suffer. He said, but you do, with a big smile on his face. And I thought, yeah, you're right. But that's the positive message the Buddha gave us, really, the most positive message, is that whatever state you're in, you can walk the path out of it. And interestingly enough, and I worked with a guy the other day, it was really sad. This guy, his daughter asked me to go and see him. He's at a retirement resort. And the apartment that he was in was about $3.5 million. So we're talking, and I mean resort, this is a 5-star retirement place. And his daughter asked me to go and see him. She said, my father is very, very unhappy because his life is out of control. And when I went to see him, he answered the door, not a skerrick of a smile. I saw his wife and she went, and I followed him. He was obviously not in good health, and I followed him into the room and he said, oh yes, and my daughter thinks meditation will help me. The thing I noticed about the house was it was absolutely unbelievably neat. I don't think I've ever been to a place where everything was lined up. As we walked through to the room where I was going to teach him meditation, he turned a lamp was dimmed and he turned it up slightly. It was brighter so I could see my way. I could see it was daytime. And we sat down and this guy looked at me and he said, I can't remember the last time I was happy. He said, I can't remember the last time I was happy. And I went, why? He said, well, my life's in a mess. He said, my wife got sick and the medication affected her mind. She's coming out of it now. And he said, I had to have a hip operation. And what I got out of this, and I can't say it clearly because I didn't discuss it so well, is this man was very wealthy. He had an unbelievably controlled life. He had businesses that were successful. Everything was ordered in his life. And I think he thought when he retired that he would have this wonderful ordered life. He could go on holidays and do all these things. But old age destroyed this material comfort in the fact that he was unwell and his wife was unwell, and he wasn't in control. And no one had really talked to him about that. The only thing you actually have in control is your mind. The mind is the source of your happiness, not what you can put together. And I felt really sorry for this guy. And I said, well, I said, I'm going to teach you to meditate. And I said, I took some articles with you, and I said, I've given you an article called The Happiest Man in the World, which I didn't know. I didn't know he was depressed. The daughter said, oh, he needs to meditate. She hadn't actually told me that he was depressed. I think I found that out when I got there. And funnily enough, I'd taken this thing, the Happiest Man in the World, because they'd done this experiment in Wisconsin University for a Buddhist meditator of 30 years, and they found in the mind that the area of the left temporal lobe, once that's excited, you experience happiness. When the right temporal lobe is more active, you experience more negativity. And they found that this meditator of 30 years, this area was enlarged, and compared to the normal people, it was way off the scale of activity, even when he wasn't meditating. So this Wisconsin University man, you can find it on the internet, this professor labelled it the happiest man in the world. He said, this guy is really happy. When he meditated on compassion, in that they put all the electrodes on, it went totally off the scale. So the moment he thought of compassion for others, he got even happier. The Buddhist paradox, the more you give away, the more you get. My teacher, who arrived in Australia in 1977 with $10 American dollars in his shoe, was able to, in the last 10 years of his life, was able to give, with his centre, $1 million in charity. Gave away $1 million. A small little Buddhist centre was able to raise $1 million and give it to everybody. And I mean everybody. There was one letter I saw came from a woman whose whole family had been killed in a car accident in South Australia, and she was left basically an orphan at 16 years of age. And my teacher heard about this, and he made everyone put some money in and send it to her. And I saw the letter, and it said, Dear Mr. Loden, Geshe Loden, Dear Mr. Loden, I am not a Buddhist. I have never heard about you before or had any contact with you whatsoever. And yet you have sent me $2,500. And all I can do is say thank you for your generosity. Bingo. Didn't ask her to become a Buddhist, didn't do anything, just gave it away. He heard of one woman in the district that was saving cats, getting feral cats and saving them. So what did he do? Made everyone put money in for a collection to help her fund her cat refuge. And that's generosity. And he once said, someone said to him once, this is a monk from another centre, how come your centre is so prosperous and yet we don't know how the money comes? And he said, it comes from the ocean. He said, what do you mean the ocean? He said, the ocean of non-grasping. That's where prosperity comes from. If you haven't got enough and you always want more, you'll never have enough. Nothing can fill up a greedy man's hand. But once you start to give it away, you get everything. Not only do you get the joy of giving, but it all comes flooding back in unusual ways. Things will happen. All right, I've done it. The road to happiness. Thank you very much, everybody. Are there any last questions? No? Okay, well, I hope you all have a really, really lovely rest of the weekend. Be kind to everybody and everyone that you meet. And thank you again for inviting me. Appreciate it.